At Glen Ellen, Charmian, habitually a late sleeper, awoke with a start about 5 a.m., wondering what could have disturbed her so. She had just lain back down when the tremor struck, first a sickening few lurches, followed by a pause. Then it seemed as if some great force laid hold of the globe and shook it like a gargantuan rat. All gathered in the living room, comparing their observations, having seen the surrounding trees thrash crazily as if the winds of all quarters were at loggerheads. Within a half hour, London and Charmian were mounted, riding for the Beauty Ranch. From its height, they made out two distant columns of smoke, one in the direction of San Francisco, and then their attention was diverted toward Santa Rosa, which was also devastated by the quake. London wondered aloud whether the city had been swallowed by the sea, or whether the Atlantic might even then be lapping at the other side of the Rockies. The earthquake that Jack London and his wife experienced on April 18, 1906, is one of the most famous, but it wasn't among the most powerful since 1900. And even at 9.0 on the Richter scale, last year's catastrophic quake off the coast of Japan ranks fourth. Are we due for another big one? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Are earthquakes more frequent than they used to be? Is it possible that human activities such as fracking can cause them? And is there a connection between earthquakes and volcanoes? Our guest is Clifford Thurber, professor of geoscience at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me.
We like to think of the Earth as solid and steady, and we use expressions like we're grounded or he has both feet on the ground. So it's kind of a scary thing, isn't it, to think of the Earth as quaking?
Right. And I mean, the good news is they don't happen all that often. But the other thing to think about is that the Earth is always moving. So we talk about the plates of the Earth, the tectonic plates moving around. They don't move very fast. But for example, New York and London are getting further apart by about 3 centimeters a year. Very, very slow, very steady. But, you know, it's not killing anybody.
But we seem to have at least relatively unnoticed quakes all the time. You can get these apps on your cell phone now. And this is a sample one that says this is as of yesterday, or actually within the last 24 hours. 6 hours ago, there was one in northwest Kashmir, 5.6. 14 hours ago, one in southern mid-Atlantic ridge, 5.2. 18 hours ago, one in the Andrianov Islands at 5.0, and at the same time, Carlsberg Ridge at 5.2, and then yesterday at 6 a.m. on the Alaskan Peninsula, a 5.6.
Right. The statistics of earthquakes tell us that the smaller you go, the more there are. And so actually, you'd expect to have several magnitude 5 and greater earthquakes every day somewhere in the world, and a magnitude 6 and bigger every few days.
And then, of course, the human perspective on it is if they are in remote areas or if they're very far down. I mean, some of these are, what, 10, 20 miles down?
Earthquakes can be up to, do this, I can do it in kilometers, 650 kilometers deep in the earth, but those ones that deep hardly ever do any damage.
Do you ever find it frustrating to tell people you're a seismologist? Because I would think the natural question might come, you know, why didn't you predict that there would be this terrible quake in Japan then? Or, you know, are we getting any better at it? It seems as if despite science, we're still seeing incredible devastation.
Right. And it seems like it's getting worse. And in some ways it is. So as a seismologist, I do have this kind of mixed feeling in that, you know, I feel like I'm doing something useful for society. But certainly I don't believe that we're going to predict earthquakes in my lifetime, for example. So the question is, what else can we do to make things not quite so bad? And we're not totally ignorant, but clearly we make big mistakes.
Well, you can predict, I think, that along the Pacific Rim, there is going to be an earthquake of some magnitude sometime soon. But,
yeah,
of course, the variables are so many that the relevance of it is hard to predict.
Yeah, people draw a line between predicting and forecasting. So we thought we were doing pretty well with the forecasting aspect, saying, okay, and, you know, say off the coast of Japan, sometime in the next century, there'll be a magnitude 8. But there was a 9. And that was because that earthquake appears to happen on a kind of a 1,000-year timescale. And that's more than we have science for. And so it's these kind of rare events that we don't know enough about and don't have statistics on. And so, you know, forecasting hazard has some flaws.
I guess the most powerful one in, the last, 1,000 years or something that we know of was the one in Chile in 1960 at a 9.5.
Right. So in terms of what we call the instrumental record, the times when their actual seismometers recording ground motion, that one is the biggest. So that would be, say, from the late 1800s till present, Chile was by far – well, not by far, but significantly bigger than anything else.
But, okay, compared to the one in Japan in 2011, which was a 9.0,
right.
A 9.5 would be how much more powerful?
Depends how you define powerful. So generally speaking, one unit of magnitude means the earthquake is 10 times bigger in terms of how much it shakes the ground. Generally, that also means that the amount of energy is 30 times as much, and you kind of like, why is that?
Multiply.
Right. So it's a big difference. And even going from 9 to 9.5, that's kind of a factor of 3 in how much the ground moved, a factor of 10 in actual energy. So even though the numbers aren't that different, the actual sizes were quite different.
Is the biggest one we know of in this country the New Madrid one of 1811?
No. Actually, if you could just restrict it to the 48 states, I'd say it's either the 1906 event or 1857 Southern California earthquake.
Oh, really?
The ones in New Madrid, at least in my opinion, have overrated magnitudes. So people used to say, oh, they were magnitude 8.
And how can you determine that if it was 1811? I mean, the Mississippi flowed backwards for a while because of that, I'm told.
Right. What people do is use sort of historic observations and try to connect that to what an earthquake would do today. And so there's a simple kind of measurement scale called intensity that says, okay, you know, were your walls cracked? Did things fall down off shelves? Did your building collapse? And, you know, were railroad rails bent? So all these different physical observations you can make. That tell you something about the power of an earthquake. And so you see what happened, for example, in the Virginia earthquake. When was that? What month?
The recent one, you
the
mean?
The one last year.
Right.
As an example of, okay, we have instrumental measurements of size and we can also look at the intensity that it caused.
Look at the Washington
and connect
Monument.
The two. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's how you try to calibrate the past. And what we do know is that an earthquake of the same size, physical size, in, say, Virginia versus California, the Virginia one will be felt more strongly, more widely, because the waves propagate more readily in the eastern U.S.
Can we back it up to sort of the cause of earthquakes?
Sure.
To begin with? And, you know, we've all heard of tectonic plates and lava and molten stuff, but I think just trying to understand why we have earthquakes in certain places at certain times and what's known now that wouldn't have been known a few hundred years ago about the causes.
Sure. I was just thinking about that very thing today. It gets back to the fact that the Earth is not this solid piece of rock. It has an outer shell, kind of like the shell of an egg, that is relatively rigid but is broken into pieces. And those pieces are in movement. And the reason they're moving around has to do with the fact that the inside of the Earth is stirring all the time. Even though it's mostly solid, it convects just like a glacier can flow. The inside of the Earth is able to flow. And so that's this process of the heat of the Earth trying to get out, which is causing the stirring. And that stirring is causing the plates to move around. And where they're either crashing into each other or sliding past one another or splitting apart from one another, that's where most earthquakes happen. And they're called plate boundaries, the edges of the plates. Earthquakes also happen within plates. And the Virginia earthquake would be an example of that. Those we have a less clear explanation for other than they're due to the same forces. The same forces that are making the plates move are causing cracks to happen, earthquakes, within the place as well. But the details of why Virginia and why not, you know, New Jersey We don't really know.
So have all the states pretty much had, well, maybe not Florida.
Wisconsin has pretty much had almost no earthquakes historically. I have a newspaper article about an earthquake in 1971 or two, way before I lived here. Whopping magnitude 3.
Didn't we have one? I mean, it woke me up about a year or two ago.
Northern Illinois.
4 point something. Well, that's true. I guess it technically wasn't in Wisconsin, yep. But it did rattle the windows here.
Right. That was in the western suburbs of Chicago, Kankakee or something. And yeah, there have been earthquakes in Rockford and here and there in northern Illinois. Bigger earthquakes in southern Illinois. And then go further south, you get to the New Madrid area of historically very large earthquakes.
Can you tell us something about the Richter scale and what's used to measure it and so on?
We're trying to wipe that out. The Richter scale was actually developed by Charles Richter, the famous seismologist, specifically for Southern California earthquake. And so that particular scale is only relevant for earthquakes observed in Southern California by a particular kind of instrument. But it's kind of got a catchy name, and so it's stuck to anybody says magnitude, people assume, oh, you mean Richter magnitude. Well, we don't, but we just don't say.
So it's what should it be called instead?
This is the problem, is that there are multiple magnitude measures. For large earthquakes like Tohoku, Japan, Chile, there's something called the moment magnitude, which is the accepted measure for a big earthquake. And it's more has to do with essentially the amount of energy that was let go. And energy isn't the right term. Essentially the built-up force that was let go when the fault slipped, as opposed to something that measures the shaking of the ground, which is what the Richter magnitude is a measure of. So it's more directly quantifiable and more universal in its application. But that's a measure that we try to use for most earthquakes, but it doesn't have a catchy name. Moment magnitudes, like blah.
And are there places that, as a seismologist, you wouldn't live?
Well, I've actually told a few people recently that I wouldn't live in Berkeley, California. I'm sorry, Berkeley. Oakland as well. There's a fault called the Hayward Fault that's a kind of a branch of the San Andreas Fault that cuts right through. In fact, it goes right through the Berkeley football stadium. And it's a recognized hazard. And if you look at the USGS forecast for earthquake likelihood, that's the number one in California. And I think I'm just doing this from memory, but something like a 60% chance in the next 30 years that there'll be a magnitude roughly 7 earthquake on that fault. That's too big for me.
Where else in the world?
Alaska?
Most of the places where earthquakes in Alaska are likely are kind of in the middle of nowhere. Anchorage had its big one in 1964, and it's unlikely to happen again for a while.
Things settled.
Sorry?
The things settled, you mean?
It gets back to what causes earthquakes. So I didn't really complete the story there. So we have, say, two plates that are moving together, and usually one ends up winning in that one plate will dive into the mantle, sort of be forced down into the mantle, and the other one will be on top.
And the one on top wins, or the one that goes down wins?
You know, the one on top survives. The one going down, which is usually a piece of the ocean crust, gets reabsorbed back into the Earth's mantle. So it's this steady motion that in some places is stuck. And so I'm trying to think of what a good analogy. Imagine you're sitting here kind of trying to push a heavy file cabinet that's full of papers. And you're pushing, and then finally it lets go and moves. Okay, so that's what's happening on these faults, is they're pushing, and boom, they finally let go and slip. And so it's this very slow, steady buildup of forces and then a very quick release that is what earthquakes are all about.
And so if you have one, then you don't have one again for a while because that pressure point is no longer pressured?
Usually. The forces have not been built up. And there are always exceptions. So the Japan earthquake is an exception, that it broke places of the fault that broke pretty recently. And no one would have thought they would have broken again that quickly. But you get a big enough push and it's kind of like a domino effect.
And the one in Haiti, I mean, I don't remember hearing of an earthquake in Haiti at all, I guess, until the recent one, which I gather was not that powerful but happened to hit a very populated area.
Right. The earthquake that hit in Haiti is about the size of what is expected for the Hayward Fault, about a magnitude 7. And if I remember right, the previous damaging, you know, really significant earthquakes in Haiti were in the 1700s. So
another one of those long loops.
Exactly. And so no one alive felt any of that. And they were also in a different part of the island. So it's, you know, you have – if you're trying to understand earthquakes and think about earthquake hazards, you have to have a long time frame. Otherwise, you're going to miss everything.
So I gather there are some places that are fairly safe. I mean, isn't there a big stable, what is it, a granite shield over what parts of Ontario and the northeast U.S.?
The interior of most continents are generally safe. And, you know, it's around the edges that things are a little dicey. And this is true even, you know, the eastern U.S. seaboard is not, you know, a big bullseye for earthquakes, but they are you know, historically have been damaging earthquakes up and down the east coast.
Charleston, I guess, was a big one.
Charleston's the best example. 1886, I believe. I probably have it. You know, there's before my time. but there also have been damaging earthquakes in New York City and in the Boston area and obviously in Virginia. So, you know, there are pockets of places where there are earthquakes. But again, the record is such that we don't tend to see them happen like again and again to get a sense of, okay, how often do they happen?
But it must be a constantly revising science. In other words, once you have the Virginia earthquake or the one that was in Japan a year ago, do scientists then take a look at all the various assumptions they had that just got proven wrong?
Yeah, Virginia didn't prove anything wrong, but the one in Japan – it actually goes back to Sumatra in 2004 that people began to say, well, wait a minute. We didn't think an earthquake that big could possibly happen there. And so several earthquakes since then have taught us different things about how our somewhat simplistic notions about how faults along plate boundaries are kind of divvied up, that simple notion has some real problems that in particular, we're learning more and more that one earthquake can trigger another or can continue to trigger things that keep it going. And that's something that, again, people have known about but not really recognized at the scale of a magnitude 9 earthquake.
Do we have a good sense of what's under the Pacific, for example, and what might happen there in terms of generating, say, a tsunami?
That's another issue that, again, things that we've learned in particular from the Japan earthquake have taught us that we don't know enough. The story here is one that we think that along plate boundaries, there are parts of these, the boundaries where the two plates are in contact that are kind of strong enough to store up energy. And that's something called the seismogenic zone, big term. But it's where the rocks are strong enough that they can kind of get stuck and eventually slip rapidly in an earthquake. So the idea was that if you go out into the ocean, there are these piles of sediments and sedimentary rocks that we always thought of as kind of being weak and unable to store up energy and slip in a big earthquake. Well, what happened in Japan was that the sediments and rocks out in the ocean moved about 50 meters. Which is phenomenal.
Enormous. Yeah.
It's like, you know, we first hear about this and you say, that's not possible. They couldn't have stored up any energy. They're not strong enough to make an earthquake. How could they move 50 meters? And those are the rocks, the sediments that pushed the ocean that made the tsunami. And so no wonder the tsunami was huge. You had 50 meters of motion kind of sideways on something that's sloping, and that sloping just pushes the water. So, of course. But, you know, now we know. But I still find it hard to believe. I don't understand how 50 meters of movement happened in a place where the rock shouldn't have been strong enough to do anything except, like, collapse or something.
More on earthquakes when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Clifford Thurber, who's telling us about earthquakes and various other activities that seem to be connected, such as volcanoes. If earthquakes are largely a phenomenon of heat escaping from beneath the Earth's crust, are volcanoes a similar phenomenon, but just a relatively gentle way of releasing that kind of energy?
Yes and no, in various ways. Just like earthquakes, most volcanoes occur at plate boundaries, and they happen both where plates are spreading apart and where two plates are coming together. Different kinds of volcanic activity. The former part mostly is happening beneath the oceans, and we don't even see it. The latter part would be related to what's called the Ring of Fire in the Pacific, where you have volcanoes up and down the west coast of South America, the Central America, up in the Cascades in Oregon and Washington, and then all through Alaska and over to Japan and so on. So those are all related to these plate motions and plate boundary effects. So earthquakes and volcanoes are driven ultimately by what's called plate tectonics, the movement of the plates driven by heat trying to get out of the Earth. So the two types of volcanic activity – well, and then there's a third, which I'll get to in a minute. But the two main types, the ones in the middle of the oceans mostly, they're not a real concern. But it's these ones in like the Ring of Fire and also some other isolated volcanoes that do present a real hazard. So we've been lucky – you've probably heard of the term supervolcanoes. So giant explosions that created
like
things.
Like Krakatoa.
That's one, but I'm thinking more on the lines of something like what created Yellowstone. So you have this massive crater that was formed by a gigantic explosive volcanic eruption. And so there hasn't really been one of those.
Yellowstone is a crater?
It's a caldera, basically a blown up – what's left of a big explosion, actually two – probably really more, but two main explosions, and I'm forgetting the dates, but on the order of a million years ago. And we fortunately haven't seen one of these in historic times. There just hasn't been one.
So Pompeii would not be a supervolcano?
No, just a standard eruption.
Just a regular old one.
But I think let me think now.
Well, there's some belief that
Santorini probably was a supervolcano, so that was in historic times. But it's these ones like Yellowstone and a few others, these giant eruptions that are catastrophic.
And are there ever occasions where an earthquake causes a volcano?
Yeah, there have been some instances. The one that comes to mind most immediately is the 1960 Chile earthquake triggered an eruption of one of the Chilean volcanoes. That doesn't seem to happen all that often. There have been other kind of funny connections between earthquakes and volcanoes, for example. Well, funny isn't the right word, but Mount St. Helens in 1980 started with kind of an earthquake and a landslide that then kind of unroofed magma, which then exploded. And so that one was actually triggered more or less directly by an earthquake. To me, the great irony in studying volcanoes is I'm a seismologist by training. I've been studying volcanoes for a long time. And I said a while ago that, earthquake prediction is virtually impossible. That is to say, when, where, and how big an earthquake is going to be ahead of time, we just can't do it. But scientists have gotten reasonably good at predicting the behavior of volcanoes. It's not perfect by any means, but they're doing a heck of a lot better than seismologists are predicting earthquakes.
Why
and
is
they
that?
Use earthquakes to do it.
Yeah.
That's the irony.
Is there any kind of a cycle to volcanic activity?
Well, the main effect is that if you have magma trying to work its way through the interior of the Earth to escape in an eruption, earthquakes happen basically rocks are breaking as the magma is trying to escape. And again, it's not perfect, but most volcanic eruptions are preceded by earthquakes. And so if you monitor a volcano with seismic instruments and watch for the occurrence of earthquakes to change, you have a pretty good sort of first-order knowledge about you know, something is happening. Sometimes there are false alarms. You can get kind of, you know, brewing of earthquakes happening and then no eruption. But the other way around is relatively rare. That is, you usually have some earthquake activity prior to an eruption. So it's, you know, it helps predict eruptions. You know, again, prediction is difficult. It's not an exact science, but you can do a lot better trying to say what a volcano is going to do than you can say what a fault is about to do.
But I gather there are places that owe their very existence to volcanic activity, undersea activity. I mean, I think of Hawaii.
Absolutely.
And maybe Iceland.
Both those. Well, Hawaii is one of these odd volcanic situations that it's – Hawaii is in the middle of the Pacific Plate, basically in the middle of nowhere. Nowhere is near a plate boundary, yet there's this chain of volcanic islands there. And so scientists have long pointed to something anomalous, unusual, deep in the earth. They call it a hot spot. So something is anomalously hot beneath Hawaii, producing the material that erupts and forms the islands. So there are these hot spots, quite a few of them around the world, and they remain a little mysterious. They're subject to debate. How deep is their source? You know, what's really causing them?
And does that mean that they're sort of still hotspots that could – something funny or odd could happen because they're a hotspot?
The Earth is always changing, although most of the time, you know, at a time scale that we don't have big surprises happen. But I just remember the story of a Mexican farmer who wakes up one day and a volcano is starting to grow in his field. And, I'm forgetting the name of that volcano. It begins with a P, I think, Paracutin or something like that. So, you know, surprises do happen even to a farmer in Central America. It's like, poor guy.
So in other words, a volcano doesn't have to be a mountain.
It can start – basically starts underground. And then the question is how quickly does it evolve and how long does it take to become a mountain? And so I'm trying to think. The people maybe have heard of Kilauea volcano in Hawaii.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember the age of that. 50,000 years? I could be wrong, but it's something of that order. That is, hasn't been around all that long,
right.
But it's a whole lot longer than any of us live. So it's always been there for humans. But on the geologic time scale, it's pretty quick.
What about moonquakes? There are sort of earthquake equivalent on the moon, right?
Yeah. There's actually some debate about that now. And I remember reading – just skimming through an article talking about, you know, maybe the moon is still active and that there's some people saying that there's evidence for kind of some kind of stretching on the moon instead of
contracting.
And I don't know. I don't think it's a big deal. You know, if we had people living on the moon, I don't think they'd have to worry about being killed by a moonquake.
But something of the same process.
They do have little, you know, bursts that happen. Some of that may be due to the fact. Well, there's some interesting stories in the solar system of planets that are, or satellites rather, moons that are being contorted by the gravitational field of their parent planet. So, you know, if you really want to study something exotic, read about the moon Io or Eo. I forget.
I think
Eo. Of mm-hmm. Jupiter, which has all these incredible volcanic eruptions on this tiny little body that, you know, should have nothing happening. But it's all the tides that are
So it's not a thermal phenomenon in that case.
It's driven – it's thermal but driven by tidal forces. So
that brings me to another question. What is the link between a tidal wave and a tsunami, and are both somehow related to earthquakes?
Tidal wave is a misnomer. So that's a term that is in the popular domain that is what is a word for a tsunami that's not proper. It has nothing to do with the tides.
It's always having to do with the plates, the earthquake activity.
Exactly. It's caused by an earthquake. It's a tsunami. And tidal wave is just a popular name for it, but it has nothing to do with tides per se. It, you know, maybe comes from people seeing the tide recede and then come in. So I think that's sort of the origin.
Well, let's do some other misconceptions too, because we've already talked about Richter scale, tidal wave. What are some of the other things that we get wrong or that you run into sort of popular misconceptions and myths?
Oh,
All the things you wish people wouldn't think.
Well, all I can think of would be, you know, movies that have ridiculous things in them, like the movie, was it 10? The earthquake movie? Or 9.5. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I know which one you mean. It wasn't 10. That was a
10.5.
That was a Bo Derek
movie. Oh, right, right. Anyway, so some of these, you know, earthquake movies, some of them have done a good job, you know, bringing in real scientific advisors and stuff, but most of them are hack jobs. Totally ridiculous things.
Such as what? Occurring. What would we see
I
that would
blocked
be ridiculous?
That movie from my well, memory to remember.
I mean, I do remember one, the first version of the time machine, which was done in 1960, and it looks forward to the year 1966, in which there's a nuclear war. Hmm. This is set in England, of course. And the impacts set off volcanic activity.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. You know, the other one I think of is I think it was Dante's Peak, which by and large was right. A pretty good volcano movie, except what was the guy's name? Pierce Brosnan.
Yes, yes, yes.
He was in that. So he's driving over fresh lava in his Jeep and was like, no, sorry, that's not going to happen.
Cooked from the get-go.
Not going to happen. But by and large, there were a lot of good things in that movie.
Is there any evidence that human activity can trigger even minor earthquakes? I mean, of late – there's been a suggestion that some of the fracking, I guess, in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, has triggered these minor quakes in, what, eastern Ohio or in that area?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes, that there's very clear and compelling evidence that we cause earthquakes by doing these kinds of activities. And so some of it comes from geothermal activities where people are pumping fluids to try to heat up the fluids and then bringing back
right.
to the surface. Place. I'm trying to remember the story that I was just reading about. Well, that was a little bit different. But, you know, basically pumping things into the ground, whether it's, you know, to try to push oil out or break rocks so that gas can escape. All these things tend to increase the chances of earthquakes happening and directly triggering small to even medium-sized, like magnitude 4 earthquakes are very common. This has happened – the biggest case I remember is Basel in Switzerland where they actually had to shut down a geothermal plant because they were triggering earthquakes that were damaging buildings.
Hmm.
So it does happen, and unfortunately our quest for energy – you don't think about some of the consequences, you know.
The 50s and early 60s when there was nuclear testing underground and, of course, picked up by seismologists, any evidence that that kind of thing would trigger an earthquake?
Nothing. There's no evidence of them triggering anything of significance. Definitely kind of smallish earthquakes would follow. You know, you basically are making a big cavity in the earth and breaking all sorts of rock. And so certainly earthquakes happen, but no evidence. You know, they're not very deep, first of all. They're deep in a sense, but most earthquakes are happening multiple miles deep in the earth, especially the bigger ones. And most nuclear explosions are less than a mile deep. And so you're just not even far enough down into the earth to really be causing a lot of trouble.
So what attempts are there to kind of almost mimic an earthquake or to create some kind of model in the laboratory where you can cause one and study it?
There are two or three avenues for doing that. Very recently, people have been doing very, very high-speed friction experiments. And what they're doing is having two sort of circular cutout sections of rock that are then spun against each other. And there's a very nice YouTube video showing this Italian lab doing this and spinning it up for the first time and then seeing the rocks start to melt and drip out of the unit and people are kind of cheering and laughing. And
yay, we created an earthquake.
So we melted rock while trying to predict, you know, trying to generate earthquakes. And so laboratory friction experiments are one way, but it's you can't do it at the scale of an earthquake. You can do it, you know, something the size of this table. But you can't do it at a scale that would actually produce a magnitude, even a 5 earthquake, I mean, or even a 4. You're just doing tiny little experiments. Computer models are where most people have done most work, but they're very limited because we don't understand the physics at the very, very small scale, which is why these lab experiments are being done. So it's, you know, we can't quite get all the pieces of the puzzle together at the right scale to do it.
Is there a kind of a typical sensation for somebody who is experiencing an earthquake? And if so, would there actually be something that would be anomalous? Could you tell that this is going to be a big one?
So I'd say there are kind of three general senses that one feels in an earthquake, and I felt them at different times for different earthquakes that I felt. Sometimes you'll just feel kind of a quick jolt. It's like, you know, did a truck hit the house? So that kind of just a quick bang kind of effect. And then other times you might feel kind of a similar feeling but kind of more of a shaking. Mm-hmm. So kind of a very abrupt shake, shake, shake.
Back and forth or up and down?
Generally back and forth. And then the third is the most ominous, which is really kind of a roller coaster ride feeling where the ground is kind of moving up and down and back and forth, sometimes for seconds, tens of seconds potentially. And so, you know, it may be that somebody felt that kind of sickening motion, whereas they were used to feeling just kind of the jolts of the little event. And then a big one will basically what you're feeling there are what are called the surface waves. And the bigger the earthquake is, the more it's going to be generating these surface waves.
How long would it typically go on? I mean, the shaking.
You know, every earthquake is different. So a magnitude 4 earthquake, you might get, you know, 5 seconds of shaking. You know, if you're – so the 5 to 10 seconds. So that's what people would feel for these northern Illinois earthquakes. You might feel shaking for a few seconds. Mm-hmm. For the Tohoku earthquake, well, that one's just anomalous to begin with. But, you know, you can basically get shaking for minutes.
That must have been incredibly disconcerting for those in it. Right. Is it true that animals can sense it ahead of time? Because I know with the Sumatra one, there were some tales that the animals started heading for the hills sooner than the people.
They probably were feeling the early shaking and being more sensitive to that. And it's the humans have to get a bigger jolt to notice anything. That would be my reading of all this. I haven't checked the literature about people studying animal behavior. There certainly is anomalous animal behavior, and you know, clearly before big damage is happening. But I do have to think that they're hearing or sensing the ground shaking, and it's actually kind of a good thing that these sort of small jolts that happen, those waves travel faster than the surface waves that do the big damage.
This is probably a stupid question, but let's take the California area where you said, you know, that's sort of the Berkeley, Oakland area. Why couldn't you sort of send down to as far deep as it's possible for human beings to send something down into the earth, some kind of sensitive instrument that would pick up on the beginnings of vibrations soon enough to send an alert that would then help us clear that football stadium?
Yeah, that would be brilliant. And it's unaffordable.
Unaffordable, but would it be possible if money wasn't an object?
I think the answer is yes, but the technology to operate something at, say, 5 miles deep in the earth, that's pretty tough. And the cost of doing that is – well, I can tell you I had experience trying to work with a drilling project on the San Andreas Fault in the middle of nowhere. But they're keeping a seismometer working – only 2 miles, or even less than 2 miles below their surface was a problem. Electronics just – it's hot.
It's hot. Okay.
And there are gases kind of leaking through and stuff and hot fluids, and it's a nasty environment. And so to go – you'd really want to go about, say, 7 miles down, and we can't really do that. I mean, we can. We can drill that deep, but that kind of project would cost $1 billion.
And you'd have to have it all over the place. You'd have to have
Well, you could target, you know, the Hayward mm-hmm. Fault.
Sure.
But you're right. You'd have to be in the right on the right spot on the Hayward Fault too. And do we know where the next Hayward Fault will begin? Not really. So you're right. You'd have to have multiple such holes and cross your fingers that you were close enough to catch something.
The problem with earthquakes from a survival standpoint is, it seems to me, it's very hard to know what to do in one. If you stay indoors, there's always the risk that you get squashed. If you go outdoors, there's always the risk that the ground will just open up and drop you in.
Most places, you're safest outside, as long as you get away from facades that might come down on you and as long as you're not standing on something that will collapse. There are cases – I mean, an earthquake itself is not going to create a crack in the ground that opens, but landslides could. So, you know, so you're not guaranteed of anything. You know, if you can't get outside, get under a really, really heavy table or a heavy desk, or if you can't even do that, stand in a door frame. Because door frames are really strong and things can collapse down around you. And if you're in the door frame, you might
elevator
do
shafts.
Okay. I don't think I'd go there. Stairwells, I'd stay off of stairwells too.
We'll have a few further observations about volcanoes and earthquakes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
It is estimated that there are 500,000 detectable earthquakes in the world each year. 100,000 of those can be felt, and 100 of them cause damage. That's one of the earthquake facts included in the U.S. Geological Survey website. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Clifford Thurber, and we are talking about earthquakes. I have to ask what drew you into this field, and I guess what you find the most fascinating about it, studying earthquakes.
Yeah, my own history of getting to become a seismologist is a circuitous one. I didn't really know what I wanted to do in college, thought I wanted to be a chemistry major, found out that I hated organic chemistry, fell back into math for a little while, thought maybe I'll do psychology. But then the thing that really caught my attention actually was Carl Sagan, who I had for a class, and just the planets just seemed really exciting to me. So I thought I would become a planetary scientists, and I started my graduate career in that direction, and then pretty quickly realized that, you know, I probably wasn't going to get a job. And so I kind of segued from studying the planets to actually studying the Earth, which is the most conveniently located planet of all. And so the studies I had started to do, kind of studying the physics of planets, I just turned around to studying the physics of the Earth, geophysics. And after a couple of years of kind of, you know, getting my feet wet, I decided that seismology was a field where there was really some exciting opportunities. And I went for it. I've been a seismologist ever since.
What do you find most exciting about it? Most fascinating, I guess, when you just can't believe it feeling.
The thing that drew me the most to seismology was the ability to try to see inside the Earth using seismic waves. So just like doctors use CAT scans to see inside your brain or whatever, or you know, other kinds of medical imaging. We do seismic imaging to look inside the Earth at a variety of scales. And that's mostly – the main thing I've done in my career is working in that area.
How far down can you go with that?
You can see the whole globe, and there's some really cool studies that have been done of the Earth's innermost core.
You can see the core that way.
Absolutely.
How can you get down that deep with any image?
Most interesting work that's come out of studying the core has used I'm trying to remember whether they were using nuclear explosions or just earthquakes. But there are many places around the world where earthquakes happen kind of repeatedly. So essentially the same earthquakes happens over and over again over time. And so over several decades of time, you would have the same earthquake happening somewhere. And then you have stations all around the world observing that. And so if everything in the Earth was staying the same, then the seismic waves you would see from that repeating earthquake should always look exactly the same at all the stations. But people found that for paths going through the Earth's inner core, the seismic waves changed. And they explained that by the core not being uniform and also rotating at a different rate than the rest of the Earth. It's like, wow, that's crazy.
Well, it's molten for one thing, right?
The inner core is solid. The outer core is molten. And so there's the ability for them to rotate at a different rate. But why would you think that would be the case? I mean, shouldn't it all be just spinning around?
Right.
But no, there's very clear evidence of a very slow change in the orientation of the rotation rate being a little different than the rest of the world. And that's pretty cool. It's not something I did, but you know, it's kind of a neat thing. So at the scale of the whole Earth, people use seismic imaging to hunt for oil. And there's some very cool techniques now that don't even require an ounce of human energy. You just sit there and you listen to the Earth, and the Earth images itself. Something called ambient noise imaging. So there's all sorts of really cool things that have been happening.
But the Earth
is that's one side of it. One side of seismology is imaging the Earth, and the other side is figuring out about earthquakes. And so it's this dual thing that was very interesting.
Is the Earth cooling? Is that part of really why the plates are compressing and creating earthquakes?
It's not cooling at enough of a rate for the Earth to like to be shrinking. But it's just the escape of energy, the sort of churning of the inside that's driving all these motions. And so, plate tectonics will go on. Well, it's been happening for at least a billion years, probably more, possibly 3 billion years. People argue about when did plate tectonics start. And it will probably go on for at least another 3 billion years before things start to cool down enough to shut down the system.
Are geysers and hot springs just kind of minor results of that same phenomenon?
Yeah, basically they're places where they're usually related to volcanism of some kind somewhere. That there's some excessive heat source which is molten rock inside and fractures allowing fluids to flow down and get heated up and then flow back up to the surface. Sometimes you get places like Yellowstone where the geysers do phenomenal things. And that heat is due to the fact that Yellowstone is a volcanic center.
Increasingly, it seems as if there are multiple scientific disciplines that get brought together to study one thing. For example, with cancer, where you might bring together immunology and genetics and just all kinds of different areas of science. In the case of an earthquake, what different disciplines come together?
In the last couple decades, seismologists have become increasingly intertwined with people who use geodesy to study the Earth.
And geodesy?
Geodesy. So just think GPS. So position on the Earth and the fact that positions change. And so if you have a place where two plates are coming together, you can actually measure that. And you can measure where the fault is stuck and where it may just be kind of slipping not dangerously. So this whole field, GPS observations are one class of geodetic technique. And probably the most exciting in some ways is something called INSAR, which is satellite radar imaging. And you can basically take a radar image of a region, come back later and take another radar image and take the difference and see how the Earth has moved in between. And it's a phenomenal technology. It requires having a $100 million satellites floating around. So it's not cheap, but if the satellites are there, they do amazing things to show you faults, building up forces, what happened when an earthquake let go, volcano inflating, amazing stuff from that.
Now, you said you've experienced, what, 4 earthquakes?
Oh, 4 or 5. Only one that was enough to scare me.
And you were kind of asking for it, I gather. I mean, you were out there looking for earthquakes.
No,
is there a way to do that?
No. I barely felt one earthquake in Madison from a Northern Illinois earthquake. The one that scared me was back in 1979. I happened to be at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California, sitting at the desk of one of my colleagues who wasn't there, and I was writing him a note saying, "Hi, Bill, you weren't here, blah, blah, blah." Then the building started to shake. So I ran for the doorframe because there was nothing for me to hide under and stood and waited it out. It was a magnitude 5.7 earthquake 50 miles away. But it shook the building for 20 seconds. So I was pretty scared.
Yeah.
And so, I gather there are a couple of places, though, if you were somehow, I'm not sure how studying earthquakes works when you're actually experiencing them. But if there is a place you would actually go to experience one, where would that be where you could say, oh, there's bound to be one fairly often here?
Right now, Christchurch, New Zealand.
Oh, really?
They are still feeling aftershocks from, you know, basically an earthquake sequence that started back in September 2010. And then they had a really damaging earthquake in February 2011. I'm involved in a study of that whole earthquake sequence. But those earthquakes are still happening. Not, you know, it hasn't been a six for a while, but they're having magnitude 3 and 4 earthquakes virtually daily.
Mm-hmm. And so these would be called aftershocks?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what do you – I know that it's frustrating if you're in a field where you want a long time span in order to reach conclusions. But what do you realistically think we may in 20 years or 50 years be able to know and do that we can't now?
Boy, that's a good question. I think we can point to I guess I come back to geodesy as being one place where we have a real chance to make some difference, and that would be in the offshore area. Most work measuring the deformation of the Earth is most easily done on dry land. And you can imagine, well, for example, GPS does not work at the bottom of the ocean. And so we have to learn techniques to actually instrument the ocean bottom and watch the ocean deform. And the reason for that is most of these giant earthquakes are happening in what are called subduction zones, which are beneath the ocean on the edge of a continent. So Chile, Japan, for example, and Sumatra are all subduction zones where you've got land, but all the earthquake activity is mostly offshore. And so we have to figure out a way to economically monitor what's happening offshore so that, for example, tsunamis, even just tsunami warnings could be possible. If you see 20 meters of motion all of a sudden on your seafloor instruments, you say, get the heck out of there. So I think that's the one place where there's a real chance for making a big difference. And it may take decades before someone benefits from it, but sooner or later, it'll pay off.
But it would be more of a technological advancement, perhaps?
Right. And that's,
instruments,
you know, pretty much where all the advances are coming from, you know, better instruments, denser observation networks. You know, the kind of underlying science is pretty mature, but we need the better observations to make real progress.
Clifford Thurber has been our guest for this hour. Thanks for giving us some insight into earthquakes and volcanoes.
My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.